Aggression has started again in the Far East. The attack by the armed forces of North Korea on South Korea has been denounced as an act of aggression by the United Nations. No excuses, no propaganda by communists, no introduction of other questions can get over this fact. Here is a case of aggression. If the aggressor gets away with it, aggressors all over the world will be encouraged. The same results which led to the Second World War will follow, and another world war may result. This is why what is happening in Korea is of such importance to you. The fire that has been started in distant Korea may burn down your house. The United States, which until recently had on behalf of the United Nations been in South Korea from the time of the Japanese surrender, came to the help of the South Koreans when they were attacked and the support of the authority of the United Nations. All honor to her and to the brave men who are fighting there. We and our sister states in the Commonwealth decided at once to support this action, and so did some 50 other member states of the United Nations. Naval and air forces from British Commonwealth countries are already fighting alongside the Americans under the authority of the United Nations. The aggressor can always pick his time. He has an initial advantage over his victim, just as the armed burglar has over the peaceful householder. The United States forces, heavily outnumbered, are fighting a difficult rearguard action until reinforcements can arrive. But aggression must, and you may be sure, will be stopped. We ourselves have to keep forces in various parts of the world, garrisoning key points such as Hong Kong or the Middle East, forming part of the occupation forces in Germany, Austria and Trieste, or engage in actual fighting against aggressive communist banditry in Malaya. Therefore, our military forces are stretched, but we have considered it our duty to send land as well as naval and air forces to help in the struggle and to share some of the burden which the United States is bearing on behalf of the United Nations. The preparations for sending this force are urgently proceeding. Our friends in Australia and New Zealand are taking similar action. This shows how the nations of the British Commonwealth take parallel action when the things for which we all stand, freedom, democracy, and peace, are threatened. But make no mistake about it, the evil forces which are now attacking South Korea are part of a worldwide conspiracy against the way of life of the free democracies. Communists, whether they make war in Korea or cause disruption in Malaya, India, or Burma, whether they destroy the liberties of the Czechs and the Poles, or try to wreck the economic recovery of Britain or France or Australia, are all engaged in an attempt to mold the whole world to their pattern of tyranny. They seek to sweep democracy and liberty from the world. They are ready to destroy our lives if we do not agree with them. They talk of freedom while they murder it. They talk of peace while they support aggression. They are ruthless and unscrupulous hypocrites who pretend to virtues which their philosophy rejects. The trouble is that quite a lot of well-meaning people are taken in by the communists and their sham peace propaganda. What is happening in Korea should open their eyes. The communists are skillful at exploiting grievances. They find their opportunity wherever poverty and evil conditions exist. We are fighting the communist menace by seeking to remove the conditions on which it thrives. We have given full freedom to India, Pakistan, Ceylon, and Burma. We are extending self-government in the colonial empire. And with other Commonwealth countries, we are promoting schemes for raising the standard of life of peoples in the less developed parts of the world.
Destructive influences have been at work. The deep divide between the communist powers and the free world has been secretly dug beneath the surface of these Middle Eastern lands. It would, of course, my friends, it would have been possible to avoid facing this danger. For a while, we could have turned our backs on reality while the tension was mounting all the time and Soviet power was steadily infiltrating throughout the Middle East. We could have done that, but for Britain, this would have meant being slowly strangled. I can assure you that even the effect of many ships sunk in the canal is a temporary worry compared with the disaster this must have meant for us all. The reality has become more apparent since the fighting. Fear of being gradually spreading in these Middle Eastern lands, while the Egyptian government under Colonel Nasser sought to establish its dominion over them all. As a consequence, the danger of an outbreak of war, which would have spread through the whole Middle East, make no mistake about that, was immediate and menacing. It wasn't only a question of an Arab-Israel conflict, which has been with us ever since the armistice of 1949. Graver still in the long run, both for our interests and for peace, was the growing military power of the Egyptian dictator framing plans of conquest which he has never attempted to conceal. Well, I know that many have expressed surprise at the vast extent of captures of Soviet equipment made by the Israeli forces in the Sinai Peninsula. They certainly seem to be larger than was required for the Egyptian forces stationed there. Well then, who can really doubt that aggressive plans had been long and carefully laid? They had indeed been proclaimed. And in all this dangerous activity, of which the seizure of the canal formed only a part, no one should have doubted that an explosion was inevitable sooner or later. Mr. Chairman, we make no apology and will never make one for the action which we and our French allies took together. However drastic our action, and however unpopular, it limited the conflict, it extinguished it, gave the world a chance to work for a solution on the basis of reality. The truth is that we have checked a drift which would have ended in the loss of countless lives and more other evils than we can ever estimate. In a lifetime spent in international affairs. That is the message I give to you today.
One thing is clear, words are not enough. The nations require some assurance of safety before they will act. If this is given, the rest will follow. It's very easy to say, we will get rid of all our armaments, whether nuclear or non-nuclear, whether conventional or unconventional, if others do the same. But the key of it all is faith. And in the present state of the world, faith cannot grow on its own. It must be strengthened, fortified, buttressed. by practice. I ask any member of this assembly honestly to face the problem with himself and in relation to his neighbors. In the vital matter of national survival, it isn't enough just to sign agreements. It is absolutely essential to have the assurances that these agreements will be rigorously adhered to. And that leads us straight into the problem. Question of international inspection and control. The Assembly has heard the dramatic declarations first by the President of the United States, then by the Prime Minister of Canada. President Eisenhower said, we are prepared to submit to any international inspection, provided only it is effective and truly reciprocal. Mr. Diefenbaker said, Canada is prepared to make available for international inspection and control any part of the Canadian Arctic Territory in exchange for a comparable concession on the part of the USSR. And yesterday, the government of Denmark said that they would be ready to consider making the same offer in respect of the vast area of Greenland. I will add this. The United Kingdom will gladly allow any form of inspection and control that is accepted by the Soviet Union. So, if these offers could be taken up, no doubt they will be taken up. This assembly could not fail. But can they be taken up? Is there some obstacle? And if there is, can we help to remove it? We have, I think, to recognize that some governments believe, and this is the objection that the Soviet representatives have often expressed in the past, that inspection and control is merely, might be just a kind of cover for espionage. Of course, let us be frank. None of us particularly will welcome in our countries a large number of officials from abroad. I'd like it translated if you would say anything. I say none of us would particularly welcome a large number of officials from abroad who might be necessary to inspect, control all the variations of armament production in its widest form, the atomic plants as well as the factories for making aeroplanes, guns, warships and the rest. And I realize also, and I want to be fair in this, that some countries, partly because of their historical traditions, partly because of the very state of world divisions, regard with suspicion, natural suspicion, and would wish to reduce to a minimum any international inspectorate. And yet, if we are to succeed, we may as well be realistic about it. We have somehow got to overcome these doubts, however reasonable they may be. Fear of espionage, fear of strangers, resentment of the fact that words are not enough, that each nation needs to be reassured and reinsured by effective inspection and control. All these misgivings are very human, but they must not stand in the way. And if we succeed, if disarmament can progress step by step, keeping time with the setting up of the controls, then these fears and suspicions will begin to fade. They will wither away. The Test Ban Treaty, initialed in Moscow by the United States, the Soviet Union, and ourselves, is an event of surpassing importance. For it is the first time, really, that East and West have agreed on a step towards the control of the terrible power of nuclear force. In itself, of course, it may only be a small step, but it could be the first of many. It is, at any rate, a step forward, a big step forward. It gives us a new opportunity, which we must not fail to seize. And in this long,
was Pilgrim's Progress. There have been many setbacks and many disappointments. I would like to pay a special tribute to the governments and peoples of the United States. They have the greatest power. Therefore, they must carry the heaviest burden of responsibility. Successive American governments have been as conscious as our own of the dark shadow that nuclear weapons have thrown over the whole world. It's true, of course, we must not forget it, that the balance of nuclear power in the West and the East has helped to avert war, but it has not brought peace. It has given us a truce based on fear. In modern conditions, no great country, however powerful, can win a war. Even an act of treacherous aggression would inevitably involve unacceptable destruction for the aggressor. So we are in this strange, uneasy balance. Because each has the power to destroy themselves, the other, and indeed the whole civilized world. That's how we live.
Sir, it is traditional at this banquet to review the part which Britain plays on the international stage. And just for a few moments, I want to ask the question, why we need wealth to sustain Britain's foreign policy? The answer in two words is security and peace. And peace is our goal, and we passionately seek it, because it is the way of life which we are charged by our religion to practice. And it is also our free choice, because we know that war impoverishes us as a nation and exhausts us as a people. And here again, in the field of foreign affairs, there is another question which has been with us almost as long as we can remember. It is how to prevent an aggressor bent on expansion overrunning free men. The question has been more acute for years because the communist philosophy has included the use of force as an instrument of policy. And it has also been, of course, made more acute still, because in these days you cannot isolate or contain a war when the weapons on each side are nuclear bombs. I shall say to you in a moment that I believe that we may be over the watershed of danger, as I've described it, with the Soviet Union. But if so, it is because the deterrent has deterred. And above all, because the Polaris submarine, a second strike weapon, has convinced the Soviet Union that war is too dangerous, because no one, not even the largest country, neither the Russians nor the Chinese, could escape the Holocaust. Some in our country sincerely hold that nuclear arms are either wicked or too expensive, or for others and not for us. If the deterrent has stopped war, then nuclear arms are none of these things. My Lord Mayor, this is not the place to debate these matters, because they may be controversial and we shall take them up in Parliament. But I would only make two comments on what I have myself said. I do not believe that our people have so lost their sense of purpose that they will not continue to pay 7% or around 7% of the gross national product for the security of Britain. And if there is to be nuclear power in the world, and we have to remember that Russia, the United States, and soon France are going to have their own independent nuclear arm, Well, then I would say to the country that we in Britain will not get to the peace table by grace and favor. The world is not like that. The way we shall get to the peace table is to be there as a right, because we are a nuclear power. It may be, and ladies and gentlemen, we are talking of terrible things and a policy which contains risk. It may be that if we achieve international disarmament, balanced disarmament, both nuclear and conventional, that we can change our decision. But until I see the pattern of the world's armaments much more clearly than I can today, and no one else really can see it more clearly than one who has been Foreign Secretary of Britain for 3 years, I must advise our people to retain the ultimate control over our own nuclear arms. Sir, I have not talked of many aspects of our international affairs. I have not talked of the Commonwealth's influence in preventing the division of the world on racial lines, perhaps the greatest danger for the future. I have not talked of our relations in this country with the continent of Europe, or the urgent tasks facing us in the underdeveloped countries of the world. I have concentrated on the overriding need to stop the nations of the world thinking in terms of war. And of course, I have not mentioned a great many subjects, because, my Lord Mayor, I must keep something for next year. Sir, I confess that I have been intrigued by your motto, Felix et Stabilis. I think I would translate it for the benefit of the bankers and mathematicians and scientists, as you can have a gay heart if you have a quiet conscience. And for the Chancellor of the Exchequer, as growth without inflation. But here I stand in the place where my predecessor for 7 years has led the government and has made a great contribution to the peace of the world. And I'm very glad, and so are you, I know, ladies and gentlemen, that the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty was signed and ratified before Mr. Macmillan fell ill and during his time as Prime Minister. And following him, I join with Mr. Butler in giving you this pledge, that we will work as a government, and all my colleagues will agree with this, to modernize Britain and make this a happy nation. And the Foreign Secretary and I will pledge ourselves that we will work untiringly for security and peace, so that the City of London and men and women everywhere may go about their lawful occasions without fear.